There is no point talking to you, because all you are is a child growing older.
What's this supposed to mean?
It means we're not making forward progress like real grown-up adults living our lives, because I'm married to a gambling junkie who won't listen.
Charlene, get in the fucking car.
What am I doing in this rat bastard situation?
You're not! What do you want from me? Leave the bank book and the car keys in the kitchen on your way out the door. Now, are we going or are we going
alone? You could keep that other crap, but Dominic would go with me.
Don't you think about it.
Let's get together. I'll say it first. We all love fun. And it's time for Kill Me Cast. Yeah, it's time for Kill Me Cast.
Welcome to KilmerCast. Here is your host, Francis Rizzo III.
Thanks, Bernard. Welcome all the Val Pals out there listening to a new episode of KilmerCast. I'm your host, Francis Rizzo III, and I'm here to talk about the films of Val Kilmer, one of the most truly enthralling American film actors of the modern era. On this episode, we'll be checking out Kilmer's role as a hard gambling bank robber in 1995's Heat. Joining us to chat about the film and Kilmer's role in it is the editor-at-large of Talk Film Society and the co-host of the Monsters Never Die podcast. It's Matt Curione.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, how's it going? It's been a little while since we've seen you around these parts. How's life treating you?
I'm doing pretty good, you know, all things considered with everything, you know.
All of this.
Yes, gestures everywhere. But no, things are doing well.
That's good to hear. I'm curious, what's keeping you busy lately? What's keeping you, you know, away from focusing on the malaise of general life?
Oh, God. Well, I'm watching a lot of movies, and yeah. We just came up on the 1 year of Monsters Never Die, which is great. A lot of fun. We got a sponsorship for the podcast. That's a lot of fun. Shout out to superyaki.com, a purveyor of fine apparel.
Nice.
I'm actually, for the first time in a while, not wearing a shirt by them, but it's fine. But yeah, I mean, I'm just having fun trying to do the best I can, honestly.
Yeah. What's the most recent thing you've watched that's really caught your eye?
Well, tonight I just watched Pop Star. Never Stop, Never Stop.
I love Pop Star. Is that the first time you've watched it?
It was the second time. I saw it when it came out and been itching to rewatch it. So yeah, it's still one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. Bravo.
Yeah, I remember being in the theater for when it came out in the theater. I was one of, I think, six people in the theater.
Oh, yeah. They made no money. Made no money.
And I enjoyed myself greatly watching that film. I got my wife to watch it, and she was way into it, which was very
it's
nice.
It's really funny. It's really funny.
It's got some of the funniest moments I've ever seen on film. And it's got some, I mean, the cameos in that film are
just terrific.
Some of the best. I mean,
it's so funny. Shout out to the Before Times when concerts happened.
Oh, yeah.
I almost got to see them. Almost got to see them.
They had that show in the city, right?
Yep. My buddy went to that tour and that's cool. Said it was out of this world.
I can only imagine. I mean, those guys are so fantastic.
They're good.
I mean, the fact that their music is so good and so funny is incredible.
Yeah. Ugh. New album, please.
Yes, absolutely. So today we're going to talk about Heat, which is it's really a classic of the heist genre. I mean, sort of, because it really, the heist are kind of a means to an end in this film in a way. Yeah, they're a big part of the film, but really what we're focusing on in this film is the people involved in it for the most part. It's not so much the heists themselves. They are to show us who these people, that these people do heists, but we're really focusing on who they are. And I thought that was interesting for a film that really has a reputation for being such a action film.
Yeah.
It's really a talking film.
Yeah. It's more character study than anything else. And
yeah.
You get that a lot with Michael Mann, honestly.
Oh, well, of course, Michael Mann.
It's kind of what he does.
You know, it's funny because heists are such a perfect topic for film because they really
they're terrific.
They have a natural three-act structure to them because you have the planning, the execution, and the aftermath. And I think that's really why heists make just fantastic films.
One of my favorite genres.
Yeah.
I love a good heist picture.
It's got that perfect built-in conflict for the protagonist. You have this obstacle you have to overcome and you have to figure out how to get over it, and you get to watch as it happens.
Mm-hmm. Such a fun genre, and as long as you have great actors taking part in these heists, I mean, come on, you really can't beat it.
It's such wish fulfillment, because who wouldn't want to get away with something, you know, like that? You
exactly.
Want to get something like that.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what makes heist so fun.
That's like a bucket list thing, pull off a heist.
What's your favorite heist film?
Ocean's 11.
Ocean's 11 are fantastic. You're talking the new ones, the, not the
original. Soderbergh. Yeah, yeah, without a doubt. That cast alone is like God level. I mean, you have George Clooney, of course, but then you have like Elliot Gould and Carl Reiner. It just it pulls the whole thing together. I love that entire trilogy. I think they're all very good.
Yeah, I think the second and third films are very underrated. I mean, they maybe
love that third one. Love that third one.
That's a great one. That's Eddie Izzard's in the third one, right?
Yes, yes. Also in the second one. Yep, yep.
Like, I remember her being in the third one.
They make the gadgets.
Oh, that's
gotta
right.
Gotta have a gadget person. Here, I made this weird fake egg. Okay, thanks, Izzard.
I'm thinking about heist films. I was like, one of my favorite heist films. Rafifi is so fantastic. Have you ever watched Rafifi?
I have not seen that.
It is amazing film. I mean, considering it's made in the 50s, it feels so fresh even today. One of the weird things about it is that the actual heist itself takes place over 30 minutes in the middle of the film without a single word and no music.
Okay, I'll check it out.
it's a wild scene to watch because you're watching every little intricate detail of this heist, from just rolling back carpet to try to clear off space to get under the floorboards to, you know, the actual like putting back everything after you're done to make sure that you're not caught that quickly. And so that one, and Quick Change. Have you ever watched Quick Change?
No, but I do know that Warner Archive is putting it out later this year.
So yeah, on Blu-ray, yeah.
I will be checking that out. There's a lot of great heist movies. I mean, recently I just watched Bound for the first time.
Bound is great.
Great heist.
Yeah.
terrific heist. Lots of fun.
I was trying to think, what's a bad heist movie? Because like, you know, like, it's hard to think of a bad heist movie.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard Tower Heist isn't that good.
The Ben Stiller one?
Yeah.
No, I haven't watched that one either.
Celebrated auteur Brett Ratner.
I think, you really have to try hard to make a bad heist film, I feel like.
I like The Town.
The Town is very good. Yes, absolutely.
The Town, AKA Boston Heat.
Right down to the mask, right?
It's pretty good. Yeah.
So before we dive into today's heist that we're going to talk about, we need to go back in time.
Gather round as we put Kilmer in context.
So Heat hit theaters in America on December 15th, 1995. Around that time, the Grateful Dead broke up. Buffalo experienced its worst snowstorm in its history. They saw 37.9 inches in just 24 hours.
Oof.
That's amazing. I just give up at that point.
It's like, you know what? I'm going to stay inside forever. It's fine. It's fine.
I've had to shovel in the past months a couple of times, and that's enough for me when we got like 5-6 inches.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what I would do if it got over 30 inches. That'd be the end of me.
No, I just give up. I'm staying home.
Yay. Thank you for internet.
Yeah. I don't leave the house now. It's great.
So Christopher Reeves was released from physical rehab after his fall from his horse. Unfortunately, later on, he would end up passing away from the injuries. The Dayton Agreement brought an end to the conflict in Yugoslavia. So it's the first time in a long time on the show we've had good news as part of this segment.
There you go.
And the final Calvin and Hobbes comic strip was published at that time, which doesn't seem that long ago, but it's 1995.
Yeah.
I mean, that's such a great strip. I have those huge collections of Calvin and Hobbes books. And
oh, yeah.
I don't check them out that often because I can remember them so clearly.
Exactly. It's like that and The Far Side growing up.
Just touchdowns.
That's all I used to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. Like everything else paled in comparison on the comic book page.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at the entertainment landscape, number one on the Billboard charts was One Sweet Day by Mariah Carey and Boyz II Men.
Lovely.
Carrie and Boyz II Men, they each wrote this song about people they lost in their lives. Mm-hmm. For Carrie, it was actually one of the founding members of CNC Music Factory, which I didn't know about.
Yeah.
This is a very mellow song for a chart topper.
It's Mariah.
It's just funny that you don't get those kind of songs anymore on the radio. They don't break rarely. Through. People don't want to be lulled like this.
Yeah.
I mean, Mariah Carey is such a great singer. Boyz II Men, they were always great when they perform. But just, you don't get this anymore. I don't know why everything changed so much like that.
I've seen her in concert 7 times.
Wow.
Big fan.
Yeah, I can imagine. 7 times, you're definitely a big fan.
Big fan.
Now, although I very much enjoy number one as a mellow hit, number two is not one of my favorites. So this is Exhale, Shoop Shoop by Whitney Houston.
Okay.
This was in the film Waiting to Exhale, and this song does nothing for me. It's so slow.
I haven't heard this song in so long. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, it's repetitive.
Yeah.
This shoop shoop thing happens almost the entire song.
Oof.
I'd rather listen to the Salt and Pepper shoop song. Like, that's way more entertaining.
Damn right.
But, you know, obviously Whitney Houston at the time could do no wrong, I think. You know, she was, you put out a song, it was a hit.
Exactly.
And this one was too, although for me, I listened to it, I'm just like, nothing here for me.
It's lesser.
Definitely, not one of her biggest hits. Then in third place was actually Boyz II Men back again.
Hell yeah.
This time with LL Cool J.
Okay, nice.
Now, so, you know, we've got two very mellow songs, and then you go, oh, well, LL Cool J, it's got to be a really energetic song. No.
No.
Hey Lover is, again, a very slow, ballady kind of hip hop song. And it does not a good song. It doesn't do anything for me. I would hold you in my arms and ease your fears. I can't believe it. I ain't had a crush in years. Hey Love. I mean, you make a song, you get Boyz II Men to feature on it, and this is what you put out.
Yeah.
Seems like a waste of their talent.
But it made money.
Yeah, well, obviously, number three on the charts.
There you go.
You know, the hardest song, it's funny, at that time, I looked down the entire list. The hardest song of the top 20 was Ace of Base's Beautiful Life. That's as hard as it got. And not exactly a strong song.
Good Lord. Oh, Ace of Base.
You have to go all the way down to number 25 to find anything approximating rock, and that was Smashing Pumpkins' Bullet with Butterfly Wings. Well, I mean, entertaining song, but... It was just a quiet, mellow time on the charts. And I don't know why. I guess everything was going well in the 90s in the Clinton era. People were having a good time. People were making money. So I guess we didn't really need loud, angry music.
Exactly.
Jumping over to TV, NBC led the way with 5 of the top 10 shows led by George Clooney and ER. If you need any proof as to the popularity of Friends and Seinfeld, which were number 2 and 5, it's the fact that Caroline in the City and The Single Guy, who were on Thursday nights alongside Seinfeld and Friends, they were both in the top 10. Do you have any memory of Caroline in the City or The Single Guy?
I do, actually.
You do, really?
I do. I used to watch those shows every freaking week.
Were you a fan, or just because you were there for other shows?
Caroline in the City was cute. I liked it.
I mean, Leah Thompson is great, but, you know.
And I grew up, you know, wearing out VHS tape of Weekend at Bernie's. So, of course, I love The Single Guy.
Oh, Jonathan Silverman, yeah.
He's the best.
I don't know. Those shows just don't. I have no real memory of the actual shows
There's definitely no, like, nostalgia for them.
Yeah, nobody's breaking out reboots of Caroline in the City.
Give it time.
I guess everything old is new again, it seems.
When they run out of all their ideas, they'll come back to Leah Thompson.
Like,
okay, you can do. They'll be like, you can do this or the Howard the Duck reboot. Your choice.
At this point, if it's in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I think Howard might be a better bet.
Yeah, oh, that would be so much fun.
So the rest of the lineup included Home Improvement, Monday Night Football, which is always in the lineup.
Obviously, yeah.
Coach, a solid show.
Yeah.
60 Minutes and a Barbara Walters special on ABC. So,
sure.
You know, nothing huge, but, you know, all those shows that we remember from the 90s that really have that nostalgia, like, you know, your Friends and Seinfeld. And
where's my Coach reboot?
Aren't they working on that?
Are they?
I think they really are. Yeah.
Oh,
no,
that's exciting.
No joke. I think they actually are working on a Coach reboot.
Oh, man.
I don't know if Craig T. Nelson is involved, but.
Well, if he's not involved, I want nothing to do with it. Like, that's why you watch Coach.
Oh, for me, it's Bill Fagerbakke. I mean, he...
Yeah.
So, although he did well at the box office in his debut, it only claimed the third spot in the chart, earning $12.6 million. You know, it couldn't overcome the top two, which were the 1-2 family film punch of Toy Story and Jumanji.
Yep, that'll do it.
Yeah, I can't believe we're 4 years away from the 30th anniversary of Toy Story. That's mildly upsetting.
I don't want to talk about that. That's upsetting.
Yeah, right? I mean, 30 years of Toy Story? It's hard to believe that this film and Toy Story both came out at the same time.
Yeah.
Toy Story is one of those films, I mean, I haven't watched it in a long time, but it doesn't feel like it aged at any point. It's always
fresh.
It's
still very good.
Yeah.
Still very good. I mean, and... This was a big time for De Niro at the box office.
Yeah, because he had Casino at that time.
The Casino the month before.
Yeah, and Casino was still on the charts at this point.
What a time to be alive.
Seventh on the charts at this time. You also had in the theaters was Father of the Bride 2. I'm not a fan of Father Bright too.
Okay, I remember this.
I mean, the first one I think is fantastic with Martin Short and Steve Martin. The second one kind of felt like a cash grab. Harrison Ford Sabrina, which I think is very underrated.
I haven't seen that in forever, but I love it.
Yeah, it was a great film. I actually will say it's better than the original.
Okay.
The James Bond film, GoldenEye.
Yeah. Hell yes.
Yeah, great time. The American President, another fun one.
Okay, that's a good one.
Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls. Yeah, not
it's
so
dumb as hell, but I love it.
And Money Train.
Oh shit, Money Train.
Yeah,
I remember the controversy over Money Train more than Money Train.
Yeah, with the attack on people inside the booths in the subway.
In the subway, and like they had to like get extra security for the New York subway system because they were like, people are ripping off this movie Money Train.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy that it had that kind of impact.
Nuts. Where's the extra security for Money Plane? That's a movie that just happened, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think
there's Kelsey Grammer.
There's a lot of flying casinos that we have nowadays. I guess the pandemic kind of protected them.
Ah, thank goodness. Don't need anyone messing with my Money Plane.
Well, we're going to take a little break and then we'll be right back to talk about Heat. Welcome back to KilmerCast. Let's get into this film. So he was written and directed by Michael Mann, a filmmaker well known for his high-gloss style and just a legacy of crime films. I mean, he had The Thief and Manhunter and Collateral and Miami Vice and Public Enemies, just really awesome crime films. And then even beyond that, like he would do stuff like The Last of the Mohicans and Ali and The Insider. There's few filmmakers that have as identifiable a style, visual style as his films. Would you agree with that?
One of my favorite directors of all time.
Yeah, and what would you say is your favorite Mann film, if it's not Heat?
Heat is up there, but it's The Insider.
The Insider,
without
fantastic.
A doubt. It's him kind of stepping outside of his wheelhouse, but still bringing his signature style to like a journalism drama, which fantastic. Yes, yeah,
I mean that.
They always say that your first is your favorite, and that's the first one I ever saw.
Insider.
I actually first saw that on an airplane. which was quite the experience. Yeah. And of course it was cut up and edited. I, once it was available at Blockbuster, I rented it and blown away. Absolutely love The Insider. Good Lord, Russell Crowe's great in that movie.
Oh, he's fantastic.
He's great in it. Pacino's great in it. Christopher Plummer's amazing. Yeah. Like that whole cast. Oh boy.
If you can watch a film on an airplane and it holds up, I think that's a solid film.
Yeah, it is. 'Cause it's damn good.
Not exactly the ideal film, you know, watching situation.
No, not at all. But no, Mann is one of my favorites. He has very few films that I just don't like.
Yeah, absolutely. A very consistent filmmaker.
Which I think might just be The Keep. Which
very early in his career.
It was also a major studio hatchet job, so... Yeah.
Not exactly.
I'm not going to count it.
No, I wouldn't.
So no, I like all his movies. That's good.
Interestingly, I don't know if you knew this or not, but Heat is a remake.
Yes.
He actually made a TV movie that he was going to do as a pilot for a show called LA Takedown. It didn't work out, but then he took that story and he reworked it into this film to become Heat, which is fantastic because I can't imagine this as an ongoing TV show.
Yeah, it would be very weird.
Like, what are you going to have
very strange. I guess it would just be the ongoing adventures of Vincent Hanna, right? Like it would just be Pacino's character taking down a different group of criminals every week.
I mean, I could go for a heist
or every season. Every season he takes down a different group of criminals.
Well, I mean, you figure it's the 80s, so it probably would have been the mystery of the week kind of thing.
Yeah.
They didn't get into the long form storytelling for the most part in the 80s, which I mean, if you did a heist every week, I think I'd probably watch.
Yeah, it would probably be, Los Angeles, Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Which I'm fine with. That'll be cool.
Yeah, I don't think you could get away with a lot of the stuff you did in this film, though.
No, not at all. No. You're not firing off live rounds every week because you're Michael Mann and you want that realism because you're insane.
Not going to fly weekly in L.A.
No. Nope.
You're going to have to go to Vancouver for that.
You want to shut down the freeway again? Okay. All right.
The film opens up and you get that Regency logo, which it feels good to see that Regency logo. That's so many good memories.
It's a good logo.
Yeah, it's
good
a great logo.
Oh my goodness.
And the movies that it, you know, was in front of in the 90s, just JFK, Falling Down, Natural Born Killers, Empire Records, LA Confidential, Fight Club, so many more.
Yeah.
Just a killer lineup. It's funny because you look a little deeper then, you go into the 2000s and really, really fell off. Still some solid films in there, but nothing like what they were at the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. In the 90s, they were like a big distributor, but they also had an edge to them, which was nice.
Yeah.
You don't get that too often.
Yeah, you get a Falling Down out of them. Like that's not a film that you really get very often from a group like that.
No.
So as we get rolling in the film, we're seeing Natalie Portman, which I was like, wow, I didn't even remember her being in this film.
Yeah, very young too.
Yeah, extremely young.
I think she did this right after The Professional.
Yes, right away. Yeah. I mean, she plays Lauren, who is Pacino's stepdaughter in this film.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't know why she's in this film.
She's in it. She's got to give Pacino's character something to latch on to. It's something that basically, like, eventually, you know, it saves his relationship.
But
so,
I mean, he's still focused on his, you know, crime fighting.
Still laser focused, but like, I think he, by the end, he realizes that I kind of do have to focus on my relationship just a bit.
I think I would have liked to see more of that because
it
felt like, you know, they felt like they kept peppering her into the film just to go, hey, don't forget, he's got a family. And, you know, and it didn't feel like it was connected to the film as tightly. Like the scene where he finds her on a bus bench out of nowhere. It was just
just waiting. Yeah.
What? When did this happen? I get they're trying to establish that she had a bad relationship with her father and it was straining her relationship with her mother. Yeah. But I don't think they, and this is something I have a problem with a couple of different characters in this film. It doesn't have a focus on those supporting characters the way it does on the main characters, which I get because they're huge characters,
Huge.
But it forgets a lot of the side characters. And, you know, and I think that's a problem when you're trying to establish a connection between the audience and who these people are.
I do really like Diane Venora, who plays Pacino's girlfriend in this.
You know, that's funny. You say girlfriend.
I think
she's actually
girlfriend,
the wife.
Live-in.
She's married to him. She says at one point.
Okay. Yeah.
But that's the problem. Is that I thought the same thing.
You never really get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's basically character sketches until you get to Macaulay and Hannah, who are like the two heavyweights in this movie. And it is their movie.
Oh, absolutely. But like you have this character who's attempting to create some other angle to Hannah, to Pacino's character. And she is so ill-defined inside this film because, like you said, girlfriend, I thought the same thing for most of the film until I found out she was the wife. And I was like, wait, that, like the way they interact, not even close. Like, I saw no relationship there that was a wifely relationship with him. I saw somebody who put up with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's on drugs the whole time, so it's fine.
I love the idea that he had that in his pocket, that he was on cocaine.
The whole time, just taken from the evidence room. Yeah. Like, that's why he's insane in this movie. And I'm like, you know what? I buy it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I totally buy this detective just going, you know, I just need something.
It makes perfect sense because Pacino in this film is a lunatic.
Oh, my God. Don't waste my motherfucking time.
I mean, it's unfortunately, at this point, I look at Pacino and I can only see Bill Hader.
Because
Bill Hader's imitation is so wonderful of Pacino.
This is like not full yelling Pacino
at times.
Which I mean, I watched it recently and basically Warren Beatty unlocked that in Dick Tracy.
He's like
Al, I want you to yell in every scene. And he's like, hey, it works for me. Let's do this from now on.
I mean, Pacino at many points in this film is the best part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Like when he's interviewing Albert, the guy, his source at the junkyard or something, I think, scrapyard.
What do you got? What do you got?
Just at God, 11. I mean, when he when he walks on the scene of the armored car heist.
Yes.
He just breaks everything down beautifully. He's just like this,
oh my God,
and over there, and that, and this over here. And he's just going nonstop. And I love it.
Yeah, well, that's Michael Mann. He does his research. He Michael Mann does lots of research before he even attempts to write a script, and it shows.
Oh yeah.
Oh, it shows.
It's just so intense and so detailed in the heist work. I mean, but the thing that above all else for Pacino is the scene when he's talking to Hank Azaria's character.
Yes.
I mean, I have a clip of it. I could not clip this moment. I'm going to play it.
Why'd I get mixed up with that bitch?
Because she got a great ass. And you got your head all the way up it. Ferocious, aren't I? When I think of asses, woman's ass, something comes
woman's
out.
Woman's ass.
I mean, that is amazing.
All-timer. That's an all-timer right there. It's beautiful.
There's so much in that little bit of acting right there. Like, he pauses before he says, great ass. And like, he's going to say something completely different. And that the way he says it, the look on Azaria's face when he looks at him is pure shock. And it's
not in the script. No. Not in the script. He actually scared the shit out of Hank Azaria right there. That's what I love about that scene.
It's amazing. And I don't know which version you watched, but did you watch the version where he said what he just said there, where ferocious, aren't I?
Yes.
Because they've cut that out of the film now.
That's a shame.
Michael Mann decided that.
Oof.
And he said that line shouldn't be in there. And it feels, you know, like,
I love that line.
It's so Hannah. It's so like him playing with somebody, you know, just
because he's in on it.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm ferocious, aren't I?
He knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
I don't understand why you would take that line out of this film.
Yeah. It's good.
It's fantastic.
Oh, God.
Well, let's get back to the first heist, because we have De Niro, who's leading the show. He's Neil in this film.
Yes.
Who's actually based on a real criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Neil Casey. And so De Niro is setting up this heist. He steals an ambulance, first of all. And then we get Val Kilmer, you know, our guy, shows up, and he is buying demolition stuff at a warehouse.
Yep. Buying some dynamite.
Just something
as one
do.
Does. Yeah. He's like, I got the paperwork. It's fine.
Yeah, he's like, all you need is a license in, I think it was Arizona, right? I think.
Yeah.
Which says a lot for Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
So we know he's up to something. Then we
never go back to Arizona.
Yep, no. Then we get Wingro. Now, Wingro is a fascinating character in this film.
He's such a scumbag.
Such
a like a sociopathic, like, lunatic in this movie. Oof.
Now he shows up and he jumps in the van, the truck with Tom Sizemore, who plays Michael.
Yeah.
You could not find a scarier pair than these two.
I know. Sizemore is terrifying in this movie.
In this movie and in reality.
Well, in real life, I mean, he's scary.
Yeah, I mean, his troubles after these films are, you know,
makes sense.
Yeah, it's perfectly clear why.
It totally tracks. I mean, that this guy has problems, but
and what's
he's a scary man.
Yeah, and what's crazy is Kevin Gage, who plays Wingro, he actually went to jail himself after this film. He was in prison.
Really?
Yeah, for some cannabis deal where he supposedly was licensed, but it wasn't correctly licensed, and so he ended up in prison for it.
Oh, it's fine.
Now it is, obviously.
Yeah. I just looked it up. Yeah, he spent 41 months in federal prison.
Yeah,
right.
It's wild. Yeah. So you have these two guys who both end up in prison, Sizemore and Gage, who play just complete lunatics in this film. And like, this movie
scary.
This movie really leaned on the method acting.
Oh yeah,
because everybody in this film is a scary person.
Yeah, like, man was like, you know, for these two guys, I'm gonna actually cast crazy people. Okay. All right. And then you have Danny Trejo.
Yeah, I forgot he was in this film also.
Playing a character named Trejo.
Yeah, real stretch, right?
Real stretch. I actually really like him in this movie. I mean, he's not in it much, but he's good.
Yeah,
he's good.
And he's not over the top in this film.
Exactly.
You know, considering everybody else in this film, he easily could have just went, you know, to 11. But he plays a more modest version of his usual characters that he plays.
Yeah. I mean, and the balls on Michael Mann to have someone like Henry Rollins in your movie and he's not part of your crew.
Yeah. He's also
he's just some bum in this movie that like does nothing.
When I realized it was him, I was like, wait a second, why is he not in the heist crew?
Yeah, he just hangs out with William Fichtner the whole time. It's fantastic.
So Kilmer, while this is all going on, De Niro's waiting in the ambulance. Trejo is trailing a guy. Kilmer's in the ambulance and he plays Christian Hurlis. Now, they described Chehalis as De Niro's right-hand man. And honestly, I didn't feel like his role in this gang was really well-defined. Did you feel like that?
I got the whole feeling that they had a past.
Well, yeah, because you have this just later on.
And this is just one of their many jobs that they do together. And honestly, I'd like to see a little more backstory on this character. Mm-hmm. Apparently, man's writing a novel.
Oh, wow.
I think it's a prequel to this. He's writing a prequel novel to Heat, or maybe it's a sequel. I think it's a prequel. So it'll have more of their two characters before this, which could be very interesting. I'd like to read that as soon as it comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because we definitely see scenes between Kilmer and De Niro's characters later on that say there's something there. There's definitely a connection between the two, and that De Niro's character really cares about.
Oh, he cares about him. He's trying to get him as much help as he can. Yeah.
But as part of the gang, it just felt very like, oh, he's just there with them. He does, he doesn't have a defined role. Usually with these heists, you have the driver and the demolitions guy and, the whatever. He doesn't have that kind of role in this gang.
Yeah.
Which I think I think
he's like the tool man in this, right?
Is he though?
Later on, he's using the drill.
He does do the drill.
He's buying the demolition stuff early on. So I guess he's like the gadget guy for Macaulay.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't know if you've ever watched The Real McCoy. We did that on this show a little while ago.
No, I haven't.
And he plays a guy who's on a heist with a massive drill like this. He doesn't use the drill in that film. He just comes out and watches it. But it's that film came out before this film. So I was like, man stealing a little bit from Kilmer.
Yeah. Early production meeting, Kilmer's like, I have experience looking at someone use a drill. I might be able to help out here. All right. Show me what you got, Val.
So as they get ready to take on this this armored truck, they pop these hockey masks on. What an iconic look.
Oof, I mean, awesome.
Just amazing. I mean, you don't get these hockey helmets anymore. They don't make these kind of helmets
and they're
anymore.
not like Friday the 13th hockey masks. No. They are goalie masks.
Yeah, these are legitimate helmets that look terrifying if you saw somebody coming at you with one of these.
Yep.
There's there's a comic book character, I can't remember, Checkmate, I believe his name is, in DC Comics, who wears this kind of mask. And I was like, I don't know why this didn't become a bigger thing, because it really, between the eyes, the way it's set, and the very hard edges of the helmet, it's a perfect thing if you want to intimidate somebody.
Exactly.
You throw one of these hockey masks on, and that's what these guys do. They are intimidating when they take on this armored truck.
Yeah, they are.
So they flip the truck by using a huge 18-wheeler, I believe it is, or
amazing.
A garbage truck.
The stunt work in this movie.
Just amazing. I was reading that they had to weight the truck's top in order to make it flip like that, because it wouldn't flip naturally, which is such a great move to do, because that flip is so key to this whole thing.
Yep. You can definitely see where Christopher Nolan got the idea for The Dark Knight.
Oh, certainly.
Flipping a truck.
Well, he's a huge Heat fan, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, The Dark Knight is basically Heat with Batman, so.
Yep.
It's fine.
So the guards who are in the truck, they call for help, and the guys start a 3-minute timer. You rarely see the ticking clock actually a ticking clock in one
of
these movies.
It's great. I love it.
It's so perfect.
Because you're right. It's something you don't see very often.
Yeah.
Cool.
I mean, it puts all the pressure. It puts the audience right in that spot where they go, oh, we only have so much time for this to happen.
Yeah.
There's such tension involved at that point.
Yep.
So they blow the car doors off the van, the armored truck, and they find what they're looking for, which I was, at that point, I was like, what are they doing? Why are they digging through all this stuff to find something? Just take everything and just run. And as this is happening, the whole thing goes sideways because Wangro, the complete lunatic, shoots one of the guards. And so they end up killing all three of the guards. And
bad move.
Yeah, not great.
Not smart.
No.
Wayne.
You're trying to keep things, low-key, and you kill all the guards.
Yeah.
Really bummer thing, because, I mean, they actually established through the dialogue that they can't even hear.
These guys are deaf. And, you're like, turn around. It's like, he can't hear you, man. I think the one guy actually says, he can't hear you, man.
Yeah, and then he still blows him away, which is such a bummer. I didn't want to not like these guys. And that's the thing, because, obviously when you're watching a heist film, you want to like the criminals. You have to be on their side. Otherwise, it's not going to work as a heist film.
Yeah, except this movie is one where, you're kind of on both sides.
Yes.
because of how well the characters are written, like the two main characters, you're kind of on both of their sides, and it causes you as an audience member to like pull your allegiance either way.
Yeah, you can't just go one side or the other. I love that gray area where you're not going to just easily choose a side.
Yeah.
So we find out what they were going for, which are bearer bonds, which that's such a classic 80s crime thing, bearer bonds. Do you even know what bearer bonds are?
Yeah, they're like savings bonds, right? Yeah.
They're something, debt.
Yeah.
They're debt that a bank writes out as bonds. But the reason why they became such a huge thing in 80s crime films is they're completely untraceable.
Okay.
There's no record of them except for the actual bond, which is why that bond is called a bearer bond, because if you bear it, you get that money.
It's yours now.
Yeah. And so
It
doesn't matter.
Today I learned.
It doesn't matter how you got it. It's just that you got it.
As long as you have it.
Yeah. Yep. Which is why in Die Hard, they were going for bearer bonds, because you can never trace where the money came from or went as long as you had that document.
It's ours now.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the bearer.
Look what I found. I have this.
I mean, the thing is, nowadays, they actually ban these things. You can't get bearer bonds anymore. I love when I learn something as part of this show.
There goes that heist I had planned. God damn it. All right.
Yeah, because apparently they were a huge, basically illegal way for people to move money around through these bearer bonds. And so there was huge problems. New laws were written up just to keep bearer bonds from being a thing. So unfortunately, they go out the window as a fun heist device. But we can always look back and make period films from the 80s.
Exactly.
So we can still use bearer bonds.
I just got to get a time machine, and then I can complete my heist.
So Pacino now obviously is on the scene to investigate this crime. You know, it's funny because later on, I think that, maybe around this time, maybe a little later, Pacino really started to become a cartoon. He really
starting with Dick Tracy.
Perfect cartoon.
He's phenomenal in Dick Tracy, but like he is playing a cartoon.
Between Scent of a Woman and The Devil's Advocate,
ooh-ah!
he really became over the top to a degree that is unbelievable. And
but he's like so good in Devil's Advocate.
He's good, but it's so over the top. That leads you right into Jack and Jill, the Adam Sandler film where he does the Dunkachino.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that it's hard now when you view that progression of his career to look at this film and go, he's doing something of the same thing, but it's working in a completely different way. It's
legit great here. Yeah.
Now he couldn't do this now and get away with it because of what he's done in the past.
Exactly. I mean, he's tried to go quiet recently. I mean, look at The Irishman.
Yeah, or look at the Golden Globes where he fell asleep.
You know what? Bless him. Because I would have fallen asleep too. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it was a interesting award show, but come on, guys.
What are you going to do?
He just wanted to take a nap.
I don't blame him.
The man's like, what, is he 80?
He's got to be up there, yeah.
He's an old man, and someone actually set Zoom up for him. Good for him.
Well, he's doing an awesome job in this film as the investigator on this crime. And
he actually is 80.
He's 80 years old. That's amazing.
Yeah, he'll be 81 in April. Good for him.
Exactly. Yeah. You get to 80, you fall asleep on an award show.
You deserve that nap, sir.
So while he's busy with the investigation, De Niro is busy dealing with the fallout of his heist. And so he meets with the crew at this diner. What a scene this diner scene is.
That death stare that Tom Sizemore gives the other customer. Oof. Oof.
Because, De Niro's character
terrifying.
Slams Wayne Grove's head into the table right in the middle of the diner.
Yeah, he does.
Now, if you're trying to keep a low profile, do you do this in the world's busiest diner?
You know what? He had it coming. What did he think was going to happen? Do you think that Robert De Niro was going to play it cool?
Oh, yeah.
Come on. No, he's slamming your head onto that table.
Yeah.
You're done.
I mean, and so they take him outside and it's clear that he's going to kill him. It's over for him. But then the cops come by and Wingrove gets away. At this point, I didn't know to expect what we got out of Wingrove for the rest of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was not that character here. He became something totally different as the film went on. I actually thought he was going to be a part of Hannah's team as like an undercover.
Okay, yeah, that would have been cool. Except, we got like complete monster instead.
I mean, it's terrifying what he becomes in this film.
Mm-hmm. Dude's a fucking Nazi.
The thing is, it makes me question, wild. When we see everything that happens, why did De Niro's character bring him in on the heist?
He needed an extra guy. I think the thing is that they lost a member of their crew.
Mm-hmm.
From what I get from the story, they lost a member of the crew, so they needed like a quick replacement.
Sure. What did he do in the heist that we needed him on?
I think he was just like scary muscle, and he took it a little too far.
You blew up the car. These guys are dead. You had guns on them from all angles. You really did not need this guy. He didn't bring anything special to the table.
Yeah.
I have to question.
I blame John Voight.
did he bring him in? That's very possible.
I blame him. I blame him for most things. Yes. I blame him for most things, but I'll blame him for Wayngrove.
Yeah, definitely. Well, now that they're done with their breakup of the heist and they don't know where Wayngrove went, Kilmer goes home and he wants to go out with his wife, Charlene, who's played by Ashley Judd.
He's great here.
Oh, he's fantastic. He's so...
I mean, angry. I know you started the show with that clip.
For a reason.
She's savage.
Oh, yeah.
And well-deserved. Mm-hmm. Like, he's being a dick.
Yeah. I mean...
and you know what? Don't mess with Ashley Judd, basically.
No. I mean, it really shows how streetwise she is.
Yeah, because she's terrific.
She comes at him saying, you're not being grown-ups because you're spending all your money on gambling. We have a kid.
Like, yeah.
You know, we need to pay bills. And you spent every dollar you got from this job where you risked your life on gambling.
Yeah, oof.
And he flips out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of Ashley Judd. I think she's a really good actress, and she kind of proves it here. She's really damn good.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and this is Kilmer. I think this is Kilmer's best part of this film, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Because
their interactions.
He takes it to a height that you don't see anywhere else in this film from him. I mean, he does some really great stunt work later on, but this is his finest acting moment in this movie.
Oh, without a doubt.
And unfortunately, very short. I mean, it's just one scene in and out, but you really understand what's happening here between these two characters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a problem, because later on, when the cops try to use her to trap him, I didn't understand why she cared at that point to help him.
She still loves him. She still loves him. It's like, no matter how much he fucks up, it's like, you know what? I still love this guy.
I get that emotion. Part of it is they never set up the hand signal thing that she uses. He shows up.
I love that hand signal.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Oh, man.
He shows up and the cops
are there.
And
then the look on his face.
Yeah.
Oof.
He shows up and the cops are there and she puts her hands on the railing in front of her. She's on a balcony.
Yeah.
She just slides her fingers from the hand away as if to say, go away. You know, like, you got to go.
This is bad. Yeah. Stay away.
And he catches it and he listens and he runs.
Mm-hmm.
But they never established that there's that kind of connection between these two.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we only got really two scenes, I believe, with them together. Mm-hmm. And we never got that connection between them. We got yelling in this scene.
Yeah.
I think there was a phone call later on between the two of them.
Yeah.
We never really got that they're so together that a simple hand gesture will tell everything that she needs to know from her.
Yeah, but then you also have the scene with De Niro and her, and you kind of get more backstory there, and like you kind of realize, wow, no, that's them, that's them. They do have this deep connection, and he had to know something was up.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I mean, he's not an idiot. He knew it. You know, why was she in this place first of all?
Exactly. Like, exactly.
Yeah, and I also wondered, why was there never a check-in at any point with this? Like, that's it. That's the end of that's the end of Kilmer.
Yeah.
And
he
so
just drives off.
Yeah. And I mean, I get it. He's the only one, you know, spoiler alerts for anybody who hasn't watched Heat since 1995, but he's the only one who survives from the heist.
Yeah.
And
that's it. It's him.
Like,
gotta go off to Gotham. Come on, man.
But there's never any kind of follow through on that. It's really an open-ended story because we don't know if they get together back afterwards. Yeah. We don't know where he went from there. Was there money? Like, where is the money?
Yeah. I'm thinking he has it.
I would think so, but I don't remember seeing it go anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Because didn't they have to run? I mean, like after the shootings and all that? The money was in the car, I believe. Well, we get more Pacino and now with Lauren. Lauren's dad doesn't show up, and so the home life is not very positive between Pacino and his wife. It's a bad time. He's struggling with her. She's played by, as you mentioned before, Diane Venora.
Yeah,
you would have. I feel like myself. I would have expected somebody of a bit higher status for this role, playing opposite Pacino.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, she had a career. She's never hurt for work. It looks like from her filmography. No. I mean, her biggest success looks like it was in 1988 when she played in Clint Eastwood's Bird, which is it's odd because 1988 is not that long ago. I mean, it's after this film, obviously, and yet it's a film that basically has disappeared.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody talks about Bird.
No.
And yet she was nominated for a Golden Globe for that performance.
Wow. Okay.
But I really feel like I need to go back and look at it because I don't know how a film that both her and the male lead, Forest Whitaker, both got nominated for Golden Globes for their performances. It's a Clint Eastwood movie and nobody talks about it.
No one talks about it.
So I'm really curious what happened there. You know, she also was in The Jackal and she was in William and Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. I mean,
and The Insider.
And The Insider, yes. And, you know, part of the truth.
Played played Russell Crowe's wife in that one.
Yeah. I mean, I can't say she made a big impact in this film on me. She's not given much of a character. She's the put upon wife of this, you know, this very focused cop. But she held her own against Pacino. I mean,
she's good in this. I like her.
I mean, if you can hold your own against a force of nature like Pacino,
yeah,
like, you deserve some accolades. And I don't. Yeah. It's weird that she never broke out past this. Really.
Yeah.
It's kind of a bummer when you see somebody who can do something like that and doesn't make it, per se.
Yeah,
like,
true.
She has a career, but she's never been a huge star.
Never been huge.
Yeah. The other half of this equation, because you have Hannah and Justine, on the other side, you have De Niro's character and Edie, who is played by Amy Brenneman.
Love her.
Yeah, I mean, how do you not love Amy Brenneman? She's fantastic. She works at a bookstore that, you know, De Niro's character frequents. And she,
what you reading about? Metals. Metals. So that's how you flirt. Okay, cool.
She couldn't be more into this guy.
And I'm just reading about metals. What?
And that's not enough
to stop her. Who says that? No.
Yeah, it's kind of weird at this point to see a younger De Niro. You know, because we're so used to seeing the De Niro we've seen for the last decade or so.
Yeah.
And here he's so different. Mm-hmm. He's not the young De Niro of the Raging Bull era.
No.
But he's in that mid-range that we don't have the clearest vision of him because he had those huge successes early on, and then he's been around forever in his older ages. This is a unique De Niro for most people.
Yeah, you have this and Casino, right?
Yeah.
Right after one another, and I think he's great in both movies.
Yeah, and here I think he has some nice chemistry with Amy Brenneman in this couple.
He does.
I mean, they kiss on the balcony, they sleep together. Weird thing in the morning when he goes to leave, he puts a glass of water wrapped really nicely in a napkin on her side.
He's nice.
What is this detail? This is an odd detail to show about this heist guy.
I have a feeling they got really drunk and he just wants her to be hydrated. He's like, you know what? I care.
This is the way I show. This is my love language.
Yes. Here, have a glass of water. Make sure you're
hydrated. It so it doesn't perspire on the table.
Yes. Couldn't find a coaster, so he did the best he could. Nice guy.
He's a sweetheart.
He's a sweetheart who's ready to leave right away. 30 seconds. 30 seconds if he has to. God damn it.
So De Niro, we meet De Niro's fence now, and that's Nate, and he's played by John Voight, who looks here the way he behaves now.
He looks like death.
He's terrible.
He's, oh my God.
I can't believe this is this long ago and he looks that bad. But, you know, the inside matches the outside now.
Yeah, good Lord. So he doesn't even look like he has skin in this movie. It's
he's just very slimy.
Oh my God. Ugh.
Yo, he looks like when those twins from The Matrix, if they left them out in the sun for a while. And
yes. You know what? You guys just hang out in the sun. It's fine. We'll come get you in a week.
Nate makes a deal with Van Zandt, who is this big business guy, to sell the bearer bonds because they got to make money. They got to get money out of this deal. They can't just do with this bearer bonds. Unfortunately, Van Zandt is planning on killing them because he's not a good guy.
No.
And you know
William
that.
Fichtner.
You know that. Yeah, exactly. He's played by William Fichtner. So he cannot be a good guy.
Exactly, because he's playing him. Yeah.
he has been in just about everything, I think. Like, this guy is
love him
everywhere. The oddest thing
one
is,
of my favorite actors.
Oh, he's fantastic. The odd thing is, most recently, he's been doing Mom on CBS. Did you know that?
That's fantastic. Like, that's, so he does a sitcom now?
Yeah, that's such a weird move from...
That is fun, and I got to check that out.
From the characters he plays in movies to Mom.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of his. Like, he's damn good.
He is. And he kind of looks like he could be related to Steven Weber, which
yeah.
is like,
yes.
It's like this weird feeling that I get about it.
Rarely plays a good guy, but you know, I think other than, I guess he's good on Mom. I guess he's a good guy.
I don't
on
even
that.
Know because that show can be a little dark because it involves alcoholism and stuff like that.
I mean, he was a good guy in Armageddon.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Around the same time. So yeah, there you go.
William Fichtner contains multitudes.
Yes.
Well,
Mr. Drive Angry himself.
Absolutely, with Nick Cage.
Buck Wild movie.
Yeah, that's a good one. Put that right alongside Crank, and I'm very happy with it.
Oof, my goodness.
Well, Neil gets home after his fun with Edie and finds Chris at his house laying on the floor. And he calls.
Kicked out again.
Yeah, he calls Charlene to get her to take him back. And so here we get some of the idea of what's going on here between Chris and Neil, mm-hmm. and you know that relationship there that he wants. He knows that Chris really loves Edie and wants her to give him another chance. Not Edie, sorry,
yeah.
Charlene.
Charlene,
and give him another chance. I mean, I don't know if I saw that though yet, that he really loves her. I mean, he's infatuated, I think, because of the lust they have for each other.
Yeah.
But I don't know if this is a relationship that really should work out.
Yeah. It's one of those wait and see approaches.
Yeah. I mean, they have this very good conversation about, you know, who they are and what kind of people they are and how they can relate to other people. And Neil talks about, like you said before, he's not going to have anything in his life that he can't leave in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, in this scene, Kilmer does almost nothing.
Got no connections.
He just listens to Neil talk for the most part in the scene. He's just like there. And I think it's funny because one of the reasons why Kilmer did this film was basically just to be around De Niro and Pacino.
Yeah.
I think it's hilarious that this guy who has had a solid hell of a career up until this point, and not, you know, no joke, like Kilmer is a very fine actor and with a lot of accolades, and he's just like, I want to make this movie to hang out with other actors.
Yeah, I just want to hang out with them, man. All right,
so he didn't care what part he had. He was just like, yeah, just get me in there and
I'll do anything, it's fine.
But once Neil establishes that he doesn't want to have anything permanent in his life, it kind of locks us into the idea that he's gonna fall in love with Edie. I mean, it's so obvious at that point.
It's like, you know it's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if they had to put such a fine point on it that he had this philosophy, because it really made it obvious what was going to happen going forward. Yeah. And even at the end when he does like walk away from her, it's like, well, yeah, we knew that was going to happen from the beginning. Yeah. Like, this is.
But there was
life.
Always that one little hope. It's like, maybe he won't.
Yeah.
Maybe. But then you see him do it. You're like, nah.
Yeah.
That's Macaulay. Oh, wacky old Macaulay. Look at him go.
Well, while this is all happening, we get introduced to Donald, who is played by Dennis Haysbert.
Yes, President Palmer. Yes, Mr. Allstate.
Yep. So Donald is on parole. I mean, I've heard about this, that, you know, people who are on parole have really tough lives when it comes to getting work, because the people they know, the people who give them jobs have control over them, because you have to check in. And in this case, that's exactly the case, because the guy tells him, you're going to pay me 25% of what you make to keep this job, and you're going to do terrible work. And so like, immediately I'm like, okay, I feel for this guy. I feel for Donald. And the problem is that the film kind of loses him.
Yeah.
He's not.
He's only like a bit player here.
Yeah. And like, so later when he, and again, spoiler alert for a film that's almost 30 years old, he dies later on in the heist. And I'm like, are we really supposed to care that much about this? We've only met him twice in this film.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, they really went out and said, look, he's got a crappy situation at work. His girlfriend is proud of him, or girlfriend or wife or whatever she is proud of him, even though he's, you know, not doing so great. And that's all we get out of these two. And you have an actor like Dennis Haysbert, and that's all you give us for Donald?
Yeah.
It's kind of a bummer.
And his shitty boss, played by Bud Cort.
isn't there a way they could have given us more of this character?
Yeah.
There's got to be a way to introduce him a bit more.
I mean, the movie's already 3 hours long, so.
Well, that's true. I mean, there's got to be something we could cut out of here. Yeah, like, I mean, you know what? Take Tone Loke out of the film.
Oh, I love that shit, though. I love it. Love Tone Loke in this movie. He had a nice little acting resurgence, little career there going in the 90s. Good for him.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, this and Ace Ventura.
What does this add to the plot?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. It's just Tone Loke. It's fine.
I really think if you're going to add nothing to the plot just to bring Tone Loke in, I think we could cut it and get more Dennis Haysbert into this film.
This is true. Maybe get a little more Tom Noonan. That would be cool.
I mean, why not? I mean, I'll take that as well.
Love Tom Noonan in this with his wacky beard. He's fun.
I love all the little side characters. They really,
yeah.
You know, for as little as they did with most of them, they really made them like an impact when they showed up. And then
every character who's in this is just like, you get it. As soon as they show up, like even when Jeremy Piven shows up for like 2 minutes, it's like, okay, yeah, I get this.
Yeah. I just wish they could do more with it. I mean, maybe that's where this really should have been a series, is because he had all these characters. You could have spread them out over a season and we could have gotten to know them better.
True, true.
Yeah. Well, Van's, they're going to do the drop for the bearer bonds, and Van Zandt's crew attempts an ambush. Like the jankiest ambush ever.
Idiots.
Like, in the middle of this drive there, you're going to crawl up next to the car. You really
think? Idiots. Complete fools.
There are mirrors like, what do you on think? All sides of this car.
Yeah. What do you think you're going to do? Come on.
And meanwhile, while this is all happening, you know, Chris is up on the top of the projection booth with a rifle. With a
sniper rifle. Yeah.
Picking people off. I mean, yay. Like, I mean, this is one of the most badass roles Kilmer, I think, has ever had. I mean,
true.
And he played Agreed. Batman.
I know. Yeah. In the same year.
But this is even better. Like this, he is so hardcore in this film. And I love it.
He's great here.
And I love what happens after this, because when De Niro finds out about the ambush, the phone call he makes to Van Zandt is so good.
Talking to a dead man.
On the other line of his phone.
I'm talking to a dead man.
He's so quietly angry in this moment.
Mm-hmm. And then William Fichtner, the oh shit look on his face. He looks at Henry Rollins like, yeah, we got to get out of here.
Yeah. I mean, that is perfect De Niro right there. That is, I don't even have to raise my voice. I am getting everything across to you by the way I'm saying these just a few words.
This is De Niro in this is how many blueberries go in each muffin mode. Like he's scary.
He is very scary. After that, they decide, well, they're actually at the same place. They're gonna have dinner with the family, with all the families of his crew.
Yes.
And again, like, so this stirs up the feelings inside of, you know, Neil, and he calls up Amy Brenneman, and you know, I'm like, this feels too by the book that he's gonna be like, oh no, I love someone, and like, you know, I want to have the life that I mean,
I'm questioning everything.
Yeah, I mean, like, was this really necessary for this film? Because it doesn't pay off in the end. It really doesn't. I mean, he walks away from her in the end. There's no benefit.
He gets a little bit of happiness. He gets a little bit of happiness.
Very minor. I mean, I guess the sadness of the scene where he's chasing her and, like, terrifying her because he wants her to go with him.
Yeah.
But, like, man, it doesn't pay off in the end because, you know, he does have to say goodbye to everything he did. And so it's like, I never really bought that he was really going to give up the life he knew.
I get that.
Well, Vincent is on a stakeout watching all this happening. Wangro is with a young hooker in the hotel.
God.
And just kills this woman. Again.
Evil.
Yeah. I mean, this
actual
is not
evil.
This is not who I thought this character was going to be anyway.
No.
Like this is Michael Mann bringing back, you know, Manhunter.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is really awful stuff right here.
It's evil, evil shit.
And he follows it up with the scene between Hannah and the girl's mom. I don't know, again, if this scene was needed, because
I kind of like it, and it foreshadows what happens later with his character. Everything's basically connected here. It just foreshadows what's going to happen later on.
With Lauren, you're saying?
Yes.
I mean, I get that, but this film really doesn't try to, like, I've always been of the opinion that if a scene doesn't service the plot or character development, it's probably best left alone. And then if you have a movie this long, you really have to start thinking about in moments like this, where if you took this out of this movie, if you did not have the scene with the mom, would it affect the character or the plot in any way? And I don't think so. I think you could trim this film up pretty heavily by taking some of these moments out of it.
True, but it adds like these nice little character moments, and I'm a sucker for that.
I mean, I just, maybe I would have liked more with Vincent and Lauren, a character that actually affects his life.
Yeah.
You know, or more with Dennis Haysbert again.
Very true.
There are moments we could have got these people back in the film more. And I feel like these moments didn't allow for that. Right now, they're trying to figure out how to do this big heist that he referred to at the metal, like you said.
Read about metals.
They want to break
this
into
what I do.
Into the metal depot and get all these valuable metals.
Yeah.
And this is a great scene. There's such good tension in this scene because
with the night vision goggles and like the thermal vision.
Oh, the look when he's looking at him through the monitor, just eye to eye, even though they're like through a monitor. It's so great.
And that one jerk makes a noise.
What a brilliant moment.
And De Niro's just like, we're done. Let's leave. Yeah.
Because while Val Kilmer is drilling, Neil steps outside to just, you know, see what's going on.
Yeah.
And across the street, there the cops are in the trailer, and the one guy sits back on the trailer and makes a thud with his gun.
Ugh.
And that's it. That's the end of the whole thing. And it's like,
he's like, nope, we're leaving. Very smart move.
Yeah, that establishes who Neil is. He's willing to throw away this heist he's been planning for a long time because he knew he could get in trouble.
Exactly.
That further tells me that anything he's doing with Edie is not going to work.
Yeah.
Because he's not going to commit to something he knows isn't going to work for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, I like that scene for this scene, especially for that, because it does a lot. It moves forward the plot because it's a heist that we've been talking about that falls apart. And we see in action his ability to give up on something that he cares about if it's not going to be the way he wants it to be.
And in this time, it was less than 30 seconds.
Absolutely. Drop of a hat.
Yep. I heard a noise. Let's go. All right, fine.
At this point now, we've really established this. We're establishing this rivalry between Neil and Hannah. And we get into the segment here that really is the key to this film, I think, in my opinion, because Hannah thinks that Neil, that they have him captured. But unfortunately, it's the other way around. Neil knows what Hannah's doing.
Yeah.
And he has him under watch.
Exactly.
And that leads into us in a chopper in LA. Now, I'm not quite sure. I couldn't connect how these scenes work together.
Okay.
But we end up in a chopper with Hannah following Neil in the car. It seemed like it was a bit of a jump for me. But I don't care because, oh my God. It
looks cool.
Yes. Los Angeles looks amazing in this moment.
No one shoots cities at night like Michael Mann.
I don't think I've ever seen Los Angeles look this beautiful.
No.
The angles, the lighting, everything is just so perfect.
Him and Dante Spinotti working together is a thing of beauty. I love it. I love their work together.
It's so great. And then when they find Neil, he gets down and jumps into a car to continue the chase. And now we go from a beautiful looking film to a beautiful sounding film. There's this unbelievable synth score of him chasing Neil. I mean, it is so great. And then he catches him.
Love the soundtrack to this movie. The whole music score is so terrific.
Yeah. So he catches Neil, and I was
pulls him over.
Yeah, just pulls him over.
Let me buy you a coffee.
A little anticlimactic, but
yeah,
still works really well because, like you said, he says, "Let's go get some coffee," and they end up in a diner, and they're just having this conversation.
Amazing scene.
It's amazing. It's so good. It is an acting workshop.
Yep.
I mean,
it's a prize fight.
Yeah,
it's fantastic. They're not getting loud. They're just having a conversation and just sit back and enjoy, folks.
Yeah, I mean, Pacino talking about how bad his life is and how it's a disaster zone. And I mean, I was waiting for one of them to say, "You and me, we're not too different." Because it felt like that was building to that. But thankfully they didn't go to that. They didn't go to the cliche.
They didn't know. You're not so different, you and I. Okay, you said it. It's okay. It's fine.
You know, but I really love that they were like, hey, you know, there's a mutual respect here between these two.
Exactly.
At the same time, you're not going to stand in my way.
Yep.
I will take you down if it's if you're going to affect me. And I really appreciate that because, again, this scene is built on reality because they were talking about on the Blu-ray how at this restaurant, not this particular, it might have been this particular restaurant, but a restaurant in Los Angeles, one night the cops would be in there having dinner, and the next night the mafia guys would be in there having dinner.
Yeah.
And they were basically doing the same thing. They had a real, like, almost grudging appreciation for each other.
Yeah. You do good work. Yeah, thanks.
That's what you do. This is what I do. As long as we're not going head to head, you know, I get it.
Do your thing. It's fine.
Yeah. And, like,
just leave me alone.
I mean, I have to, this is for a film, again, this film is known as an action masterpiece. I mean, this scene is just talking. It's unbelievably slow for a film that would be
considered an action-packed convo. My goodness.
Do you consider this or the shootout in the streets of LA the better scene in this film?
Oh, God, it's hard to pick. It's hard to pick because that shootout, that bank robbery is, oh my God, it's been, that bank robbery is so influential on every other bank robbery in movies.
Yeah.
I mean,
can you imagine?
Even Mann calls back to it in his later movies.
This is one film that has two scenes of almost equal amazing weight, and yet they're unbelievably different scenes.
Could be in totally different films. Could be in totally different movies. Yep.
To me, I feel like this is the better scene.
Yeah.
Because it advances the plot more. It tells us way more about the characters.
It's so hard to pick.
It's very hard to pick. I mean, I just think I get more out. I mean, especially since it's these two together. I mean, if it was two other actors, maybe it would be a lot easier to pick the.
Then it'll be like, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah. But these two together, just having this conversation, expressing their characters, developing who they are. It's an amazing scene that makes this film. I love it.
Ah, so good. So good. So good.
So although it seems like things are going well right now for Neil and his crew, because during this conversation, his gang all slips their surveillance and get away from the cops.
Yeah. Yep.
Which, I mean, I'm surprised Hannah doesn't react worse to this. He doesn't react great, but he doesn't. Yeah. I thought he'd be more mad at himself for sitting there and talking to this guy while they all got away. But he's like, okay. And so it seems like Neil and his gang are really doing well at this point, but this is really the beginning of the end at this point in this film.
Indeed.
Because at this point, Wangro meets Van Zandt, and that's not a good combo for anybody.
No.
Two evil people working together against Neil.
Yeah.
Not great for him.
Not going to end well.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Trejo is being trailed by the cops. Yeah. So they bring in Donald to be the driver now. And now we have this bank heist, which
so good.
The thing about it is that it's so cool and collected. It's so smooth.
And it's terrifying.
It is terrifying. As he walks over the teller stations and he's like, I don't want your money. I want the bank's money. And
exactly.
Like, don't be a hero. Like, this is how it's going to go. And you think, wow, this is going to go very smoothly.
Mm-hmm. You'd think, wouldn't you?
Especially since Wangro's not involved.
Exactly. You have that chance because it might go a little bit nicer.
Yeah. And again, that made me again question, why was Wangro there in the beginning? Besides the convenience of having this obstacle in the film.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite work logistically for him to have brought this guy in that nobody knew. Obviously nobody knew him. It's really kind of a logic jump that I have a problem with this.
I get
this
film. Yeah. Yeah.
But as they get through with this heist and they're getting out, the cops are there, Hannah and his crew, and we get the most epic shootout I think that might be ever on film.
It's very good.
It's so fantastic.
It's very, very good.
Yeah.
It's intense. It goes on, but it doesn't feel too long.
It's
very fast paced. The editing is terrific. It's got gunfire that is just loud as hell.
Oh my God.
It's so loud. You want to give your home theater system, like your surround sound system, a workout. Pump it up. Pump up this scene, and you'll see if your speakers are good.
I've never heard a gun shoot like this before. I've never heard gunfire.
Terrifying.
This
terrifying.
Aggressive and realistic feeling.
Yep. Oof.
I mean,
scary stuff.
He actually mic'd the guns, I believe, to get this sound, which is incredible.
Every gun was mic'd.
Yeah.
Usually they don't do that. Usually it's just like, you know, after sound effects, but nope.
That realism. I had the question, though. Do cops usually use rifles like that?
I guess they stopped at the SWAT team earlier.
Seriously.
On their way over, you know?
Everybody had this massive assault rifle.
Yeah.
It seemed a little over the top for Los Angeles Police Department. I haven't been to LA in the middle of that kind of thing, but
yeah.
Like, it seems like a lot to have everybody
not
having
the SWAT department. That's my reasoning.
I have to say, so many people died at this moment. There's no way. How many people had to have died in that moment with the way they shot up every car, every stop, every space? I mean, Val Kilmer is switching magazines like the Flash.
Crazy.
He's just like, he spins and loads and fires. It's just, I was reading that they actually show the clip of him doing that to military during training.
Okay.
Like, this is how you do it.
They're all John Wicking it right now.
I'm like, wow. I mean, that is really cool. That
it's an intense shootout.
It's so amazing. I mean, it's and the thing is, because once Donald dies, anybody can die in the scene.
Yeah,
there's nobody safe. Which, especially then, once Kilmer gets shot, which
Wes Studi gets off a nice shot at him.
Yeah, I did not expect that at all because I was like, oh, he's dead.
Oh wait, it's like, oh wait, he's dead now. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then Michael picks up that kid. I got sick at that point
horrifying.
I have a daughter, and like that's a terrifying idea to have somebody grab your kid in the middle of a gunfight. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah. And the thing is,
and Pacino's having none of it.
Yeah, but they established that Michael is a family man. He has kids himself. I didn't understand this moment because I don't feel like he would have done this.
Honestly, I would feel that he's just panicking right now and trying to do anything he can to get the hell out.
Maybe. I mean, I guess
He thought he was going to have a pretty smooth day. Yeah. And then this all happened. He's like, you know what? I got to do what I got
to
do.
I mean, I guess it's hard to judge somebody who's in the middle of a gun battle and you know, is going to, he's looking at either dying or going to prison for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess
he dies.
Yeah. Shot right
through. He gets that first option. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know Hannah was a crack shot like that. Very impressive.
Apparently he is. Good for him.
Absolutely. Well, apparently Kilmer didn't die because he ends up at Dr. Bob's.
Yeah, Jeremy Piven.
I was like, wow, everybody's in this movie.
Everyone's in this movie. It's even Jeremy Piven. Look at him go.
I'm like, this is 95. Piven was this old at this point?
Yeah. I think he went bald early, honestly.
It really surprised
me. Poor guy.
Well, Neil wants him taken care of, obviously, because he has emotion for Chris. And as they're taking care of Chris, everything goes wrong. Wayngro kills Trejo and his wife. Vincent,
brutal.
Yeah.
Brutal.
Just horrible. Oh, that's that shot of the bedroom. Just so bad. Vincent busts Henry Rollins. So that's done. And then what you call it? So then Neil goes to look for Van Zandt, which, you know, he said, you're talking
doesn't
to a dead
well.
Guy, right?
Yep.
And he made sure that was the absolute truth because he blows him away.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have to say, this moment.
I got time for you, Fichtner.
This moment is so quick. Like, you kind of thought you'd get
blink
a little
and you miss
more.
It.
Like, you thought you'd get a little more story or maybe some dialogue or something here.
Yeah.
No, Neil has no time for him.
Talking to a dead man.
Three shots done. And like, I
have
like,
no time to speak to you. We're done here.
Well, while this is all happening, Azaria brings Chris's wife to the safe house. We talked about that before, that, they were trying to use her to catch Chris. And Neil goes to Edie because he wants her to go with him. And this is not going to work because she does not want to go on the run because she now knows who he is. And she's not down with this. And I appreciated that she was willing to stand up for herself in this case.
Exactly. Me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
I thought it was interesting that I was reading that when she was first cast for the film, she told Michael Mann, I don't want to do this because she said, there's no morals in this film. Like, everybody is evil. And he says, that's why I want you to do this film.
Mm-hmm.
You are Edie. And I need that in this film. And I think that's great because she really is that moral core of this film that like she had a slight chance of turning him around, but it was never going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's really tragic because he could have made that choice and he didn't make that choice. And she ends up losing him. She ends up stuck in this whole thing. I don't know what happens to her after this, but I wonder,
who knows? You
know, like she's just in that car. Like is she might be even get arrested as an accomplice to him. Yeah, exactly. Which
she might still be in that car. Just waiting the whole time. Where is he?
Is he coming
back? He said he was going to be 5 minutes.
Well, then we get a great scene in this film because Vincent comes home and finds Justine with Ralph.
Yeah.
Wow.
Can't watch my TV.
What an amazing moment for him to rip the TV out of the house because, yeah, you can have sex with my wife, but you can't watch my TV.
Yeah, it's John Connor's stepdad, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, that's him. Yeah. Another guy that was on 24 with Haysbert. There you go.
They just cast out of this show. They just picked him out off IMDb.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, he was in Heat. Let's get him for 24. Okay, sure. Why not?
So he takes the TV and he leaves. There's this weird scene.
So funny.
It's
so funny.
It's so funny. Just so angry. He takes the TV. And then he's driving along and he has the TV in his passenger seat of his car. And then he just opens the door.
At the bus stop.
Yeah, and just throws it in the street.
Why? So good.
Why did he do that?
If he watches my TV, no one can watch this TV. We're done. I'll get a new TV.
It's just the oddest thing. And then like there's this reaction shot that just lingers from the people at the bus stop just looking at this
TV. They're
just
like, what? It's so funny. It's such a funny shot.
I mean, I guess this is the height of the cocaine.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that
throw your TV away.
Just throw your TV out the door.
Some other guy watched it. I don't want it anymore. He touched it.
Wow. Neil is trying to figure out a way to get out of this whole thing and take Edie with him. Nate actually sets up an out for him, and Chris has run away, which is definitely concerning to Neil because he's like, well, where'd he go? And you know, nobody, he doesn't know. Nate has no idea. Nate never has any kind of resolution in this film, does he?
Nope.
No.
Yeah. Nope.
It's kind of like, again, this film really loses track of its side characters, and it's kind of, you know, it's like, I get that you have these really fantastic main characters you have to deal with, but give us some closure. You've established these characters over 2.5 hours and you don't do anything with them in the end?
Yeah.
Really? I just don't appreciate that. If you're going to spend this time.
Maybe Michael Mann just got tired of working with John Voight and was like, you know what? No, we're good.
If that's the case, I agree.
We're good. We're good.
Well, Charlene does her thing with Chris, gets him out of there. Neil infiltrates the hotel where Wingrew is staying. This is so hardcore. You know, he says,
look at me
and just blows him away,
and you expect him to say something. He's like, nope.
Yeah, I mean, this is Neil now. At this point, Neil just does what he needs to do and gets done with it. And you know, as he's leaving, Vincent spots Edie, which I was like, wait, does he know who Edie is?
I
didn't connect that at any point there. I was like, oh, I guess Vincent knows this. He's been following.
Yeah, he would have everyone under surveillance.
But didn't they slip surveillance?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm pretty sure that he would have been checking out like where Macaulay's been going.
Sure, he did spend a lot of time with her.
Yeah.
And so Vincent spots Edie, Neil spots Vincent, and he just runs. And so now we get this great scene on the tarmac at LAX.
Oh my God. One of my favorite finales.
I mean, the tension that's created by lights. I mean, that is some next level skill to use lighting to create tension.
Lighting from airplanes.
Yeah. I mean, I did not know what was going to happen here. Anything could have happened in this moment. And I would have been like, yeah, okay, that's fine.
Yeah, I get it.
Everything
works
for this.
Yeah.
But I was surprised when in the end, Vincent kills Neil. It felt very Hollywood.
Yeah.
Like the happy ending for the cop.
Does he have a happy ending? He's still got a fucked up home life.
I get that, but
he
accomplished what he was going for.
It's a happy ending for him, but also it's like bittersweet the way, like, it's so sad the way he's like just holding his hand as he dies. Oh my God.
Yeah, that last bit of respect.
Oof. Big oof.
Yeah. I kind of thought there was going to be a double murder there.
Yeah.
When nobody wins in the end.
That would have been cool.
Yeah, that would have been very much in the tone of this film, I feel like.
But I do like the ending here. I do. I think it fits.
Yeah. Oh, I don't have a problem with it logistically or thematically.
It fits for this kind of story.
Yeah. I just felt like it didn't feel like what I was expecting in the end from a movie as grim and in many ways as this film. It felt too, I'm not going to say happy because a man was murdered and
Hannah. A lot of people were murdered.
Hannah doesn't seem particularly proud of this moment.
No, he's not. He's not. No.
Yeah. But I do feel like it wasn't as Arlington Road as I'd hope it would be.
I need to see that. I need to see that movie.
It's a fantastic film.
I've heard great things.
One of the greatest endings I've ever seen in a movie.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. I sat in that theater stunned for a good long time after the credits roll.
Oh, it's Jeff Bridges. Yeah, I got to watch that. Yeah. Okay.
And Tim Robbins in one of his best performances ever.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. All right. All right. The director of the Mothman Prophecies. Yes, oh, hell yeah. Absolutely. I'm all about it. Mark Romanek. All right, then. Hell yeah.
It's honestly amazing.
Yeah, I got to check this out. Okay, cool.
Do you have anything else you want to say about this film?
I think we've said it all, but I mean, it's just, it's one of the best movies of the 90s. It's just, it's that good.
Yeah, I mean, it's, even at its length, it never
it's this
feels
epic
like,
crime drama.
Yeah, it never
you
feels
don't
like
get
it
a lot of those. Not at all.
It's never boring. Everything is always moving. And yeah, you know, the only thing for the terms of this film, for this podcast, I should say, is that there's not enough Kilmer.
True. I would have liked a little more Val.
Yeah. I mean, he's awesome in the shootout. He's great in that scene at the beginning with Charlene.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get a whole lot, unfortunately, from him. And I get that that's because he was doing Batman. He couldn't be there as much as he
wanted
to be. Yeah. But man, I would have liked to see more of him with De Niro, or I'd love to see him in a scene with Pacino.
That would have been nice. Yeah. But hey, what we get of Kilmer here is pretty damn good.
It is good. Yes. As most times it is.
Yeah, this is true.
Well, we've had our say, so why don't we hear from the man himself?
It's time for a reading from the Book of Val.
Our reading today comes from Val Kilmer's memoir, I'm Your Huckleberry. Heat naturally gets its own chapter. So here's a little clip from that. Of course, the glory in doing Heat was the masterclass put on by Bob and Al. After watching them at close range, I'd sum it up like this. Al is Jackson Pollock. He throws it all out there. It lands where it lands. There's no holding back. Bob is Vermeer. Painstakingly, he lays one brick after another until the construction is solid as a rock. Both Bob and Al get to the same place. They embody the characters they play, but they take radically different paths to arrive there. Like children at a funeral, Bob, Al, and I giggled our way through the long nights of this dark movie. Thanks be to Val.
What a metaphor.
Yeah, I know. Like children at a funeral.
Wow. I got to check this book out. Damn.
he's something, let me tell you. He actually said the biggest reason he wanted to do Heat was to be able to call them Bob and Al.
Yeah. No, Bob and Al. Yeah. My two buds.
So we've had our say and Val has had his say. So let's hear what some other people have to say.
Come, children, let's explore the kills and valleys.
So it's not surprising to find out that the critical response to Heat was largely positive. It earned an 87% tomato meter rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Todd McCarthy of Variety said it was stunningly made and incisively acted by a large and terrific cast. Michael Mann's ambitious study of the relative good and evil stands apart from other films of its type by virtue of its extraordinarily rich characterizations and its thoughtful, deeply melancholy take on modern life. And I mean, that's absolutely true, is that it builds characters, and so many action films don't build characters the way this film does.
No, they just throw actors at the screen like, yeah, it's fine.
Kenneth Turin of the LA Times wrote, what's old has been made fine and new in Heat. Writer director Michael Mann and a superlative cast have taken a classic heist movie rife with familiar genre elements and turned it into a sleek, accomplished piece of work, meticulously controlled and completely involving. Absolutely. And then Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times wrote, it's not just an action picture. Above all, the dialogue is complex enough to allow the characters to say what they're thinking. They are eloquent, insightful, fanciful, poetic, when necessary. They're not trapped with cliches. Of the many imprisonments possible in our world, one of the worst must be to be inarticulate, to be unable to tell another person how you really feel. These characters do that, not that it saves them.
Oof,
that's a really nice review.
I love Ebert. He's such a good writer.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Of course, there's always going to be contrarian voices.
Of course.
As we know. And Heat is not immune from this. Barbara Shilgassy of the San Francisco Examiner called Heat...
That rag.
called Heat a lukewarm cop and crook drama, writing, there isn't much to recommend this movie until Pacino and De Niro finally share the list of the first of their two scenes together. What? I mean, just the first heist scene alone is fantastic.
I line my birdcage with that newspaper.
I mean, if you just took that one heist scene with the armored car, that alone is its own fantastic set piece. I don't
get worth it. The price of admission.
Yeah. Andrew Ross of Salon was even less impressed. All the squealing tires, flying bullets, and falling bodies cannot save Heat from drowning in its own banalities. Postcoital cigarettes, bad guy music used like a drum roll to herald entrances of bad guys, greasy ponytails, a sulky wrist-slashing teenager, and an airport runway chase. I mean, what? I mean, these are just things. Every movie has similar ideas to other movies. It's how you play them out. How well are they acted? How well are they shot?
That guy's boring.
I mean, are there any original ideas as far as plot goes anymore? No.
No.
It's how you tell the story.
Exactly. It's what you can bring to the table. And man brings a lot to the table here.
Absolutely. Over on Amazon, the unwashed masses have left us over 8,000 reviews, of which 83% are 5 stars. The Heat rules. I think it's just Heat.
The Heat.
And I made sure they weren't talking about the Melissa McCarthy movie.
Who is this 90-year-old grandmother? The Heat. I love The Heat.
Haven't seen it? You have no idea what you're missing. If you want action, gangsters versus cops versus personal conflicts, and the Pacino versus De Niro, this is your movie. Go for it. Get a bag of popcorn and a libation or two. Kick back, relax, and fasten your seatbelt. Val Kilmer's character will keep you on the rails. I don't know what that means. Val Kilmer's character will keep you on the rails?
Sure.
Maybe, I guess.
We can't all be Gene Shalit.
No.
You know.
This is a classic film with a great cast that demonstrates Michael Mann's keen writing and directing abilities. If you are a De Niro or Pacino fan, you have to see it. Also for the gals out there, Val Kilmer is a total stud in this film.
Yes, he is.
I mean, it was the 90s. He was a stud in every film he was in.
Exactly.
Third time watching it. Great movie. Pacino and De Niro at their best. Val Kilmer's second best performance next to Doc Holliday and Tombstone. That might be a stretch.
How many times have I seen this movie? Jesus. I gotta look at this. Actually, the first time I ever saw it was like only 5 years ago.
Yeah, how about that?
Which is nuts.
Yeah, that so many years went by without knowing about this. Yep.
And I've watched it 9 times since.
Wow.
Yeah, I watch it a lot. This is a good movie.
Absolutely. So 1% of Amazon reviews are 1 star. And honestly, the majority of them were about the quality of the presentation, not actually the film itself. But this one.
This DVD sucks.
What a boring, pointless waste of time. It says this is a psychological drama. There's zero psychology and more drama in an episode of Adam 12. This is a simple crime drama. They've taken a couple of robberies, probably from old TV shows, and stretched them into 3 hours with a lot of irrelevant scenes, like people sitting in bars or pulling up in cars.
Oh, you mean character development?
Yeah. You know, boring stuff like that.
How dare a movie have well-fleshed out characters? How dare?
De Niro sucks in this movie. Unrealistic. Bad acting by Pacino's girlfriend. Tone Loke is horrible. Somebody agrees with me that we didn't need Tone Loke in this movie.
Tone Loke innocent.
Okay, this one is a little bit of a mystery to me. I'll read it, but I don't quite understand it.
Okay.
De Niro lost me Tony Knight.
Excuse me?
De Niro lost me Tony Knight.
Tony Knight. Sure.
I think he means the Oscars. I'm not sure.
This was from when he was
talking about Trump, right?
At the Tonys a few
years
ago.
Was it the Tonys? I thought he...
Yeah, when he's like, fuck that guy.
Okay, well, there you go. Now I understand it.
So that's when he lost him. Okay. He lost him, oh, I don't know, 15 years after this movie came out. 20 years after this movie came out.
He also spelled it D-E-N-E-R-O, so... So we have a decision to make about this film.
With or without Val.
Does Val Kilmer make or break this film?
I don't think I would like it as much without him.
That's a very good point. And I find that's a lot of his roles where he brings a little something special to it.
His character adds a lot to this movie.
Mm-hmm.
He may be underused, but his character adds a lot. It influences Macaulay quite a bit.
Oh, I'd agree. And I mean, just the shootout scene alone is
like,
I don't know if any, you know, and like I said, the military believes he does a fantastic job. I don't know how many other people could do that. I would like to point out that Keanu Reeves was actually cast as Chris first.
Wow.
Yeah. But when Kilmer was able to fit it in with his Batman schedule, they gave the role to him.
So I would have actually loved to see that. Wow.
Yeah, right. Wouldn't that be interesting?
That would have been awesome.
Other people who were considered for the role include Jean Reno, Brad Pitt, and Johnny Depp was cast, but was attempted to cast, but he cost too much money, so they couldn't hire him.
He's very expensive back then, yeah.
Yeah. I can't imagine Johnny Depp in this role.
Yeah. Around this time, he was playing more like victim. Mm. So, if you ever seen the movie Nick of Time?
Yes, absolutely.
He's good in that one, but I mean, it's still like a thriller, but he's more of the victim in that movie.
Yeah. I don't view him as Chris Shahurlis.
God, now I want to watch Nick of Time. That's a really good movie. Give me a 90-minute thriller told in real time, and
I'm always
there. You've made a movie made just for me.
Yes. Anything 90 minutes, it works for me.
Oh, my God. Christopher Walken's wild in that movie.
I mean, in this film for me, at least he gets to be an action star for a bit, which I always appreciate Val Kilmer as an action star. It would have been nice for him to be a bigger role, but for what we got out of him, no complaints at all about him.
Definitely
brings it in this role. So now that we've covered today's film, I'd like to play a little game, and it's called What's in a Name?
Okay.
In Heat, Val Kilmer plays a character named Chris Shahurlis, which is easily one of the more unique names he's had in a film.
Bit, just a bit.
But it's not the only one. So what I'm going to do is give you the name of a character, and you'll try to name the film that character is in.
He's a Val Kilmer character, yes?
Yep. So for example, if I said to you Jim Morrison, you would say?
The Doors.
Exactly. So let's go. Tom Kazanski.
I have no idea.
You're going to kick yourself when I tell you, though.
I probably will.
Because you did an episode of Kilmer Cast about it.
Oh, shit. All right.
Tom Iceman Kazanski.
Okay. All right. God damn it.
Ray Lavoie.
Is that Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
No, name is much more interesting than Ray Lavoie.
Yeah. Wow, I'm going to strike out on all these, aren't I?
Ray Lavoie was in Thunderheart.
I've never seen it.
Oh, it's a fantastic film. Really, it's a must-see.
I'll have to check it out.
Yep, especially for Graham Greene, his co-star, who is just the best. Virgil Adamson.
I want to say Ghost in the Darkness.
No. At First Sight.
Okay. All right. God damn it.
How about Danny Parker?
I got nothing. Wow.
It's a tough one.
No, I suck. I'm the worst at this.
You want to get no guess?
No, I got nothing.
The Salton Sea.
That's a movie that's on my list. I really want to see that.
This one you should get. Gay Perry.
Oh, that's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
There you go.
Yeah, that's Gay Perry.
Here's one that's a little different. Willem de Kooning.
I'm going to say Ghost in the Darkness again.
No, but it's a good guess because, you know, South African, but Pollock.
Okay, all right.
I
haven't seen that since it came out.
Played a real person there. Colonel John Henry Patterson.
Is this the one I keep guessing? Is this it?
I don't know. The Lions. Which one?
Is this the one with the Lions?
Perhaps.
Yeah, it's Ghost in the Darkness.
It is, in fact, Ghost in the Darkness.
With Mikey D? Yep. Yeah. God damn it.
Colonel John Henry Patterson.
God damn it.
Here's one. Nick Rivers.
That sounds really familiar. Mm.
Name is said multiple times in the film.
I'm blanking. I can't.
International singing sensation Nick Rivers is in Top Secret.
Oh, wow. I haven't seen that movie in forever.
There's one that you might get. Dieter von Kampf.
Was he in MacGruber?
He was in MacGruber, and he played Dieter von Kampf.
Okay, I thought so. Okay. Sounds like a MacGruber name.
Oh, absolutely. And the last one, which actually you'd break even if you get this one right, is John Holmes.
Oh, fuck. What was that movie? I know the movie, too. Not Hollywood something. No. Oh, man. I don't know the name of it, but I know this movie.
Yeah. You want it?
Yeah.
Wonderland.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So, God damn it.
You came close.
God damn it. All right.
You came up strong in the second half.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's all for this episode of Kilmer Cast. I'd like to thank you, Matt, for joining me to look back at this truly classic flick.
A pleasure.
Do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah. Check out Monsters Never Die, available wherever podcasts are available. We have a few months of Godzilla in the works.
Nice.
So that's going to be a lot of fun.
They're going to do the new one.
We're covering the new one. We're covering all 33, 34 movies
wow.
in the series. Yeah. It's gonna be a lot of work, but it's going to be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Those are great films. Well, in our next episode, we're going to slide ahead to 2009 to travel to the Bayou to take a look at Werner Herzog's Bad Lieutenant remake, Bad Lieutenant Port of New Orleans. In the meanwhile, please email any thoughts, questions, or comments to kilmercast@gmail.com and follow the show on Twitter @kilmercast. For myself and my guest Matt Curione, thanks for listening and remember to keep it Kilmer.